Now, how many times have you stopped and shot something using the video function on your phone lately? The process of pulling out our phones, tapping that camera icon and snapping or shooting what's in front of us is now a permanent part of our lives. What we capture inspires and celebrates and entertains and informs, but what else can it be used for? Dr. Justin Ellis from the Sydney Institute of Criminology has researched the role amateur video plays in holding police account. He joins us in the studio now to have a chat. Dr. Ellis, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks, Jess.
Now, 6 years ago, some amateur footage surfaced showing police using excessive force on a young person at Mardi Gras. That incident has been examined in your research. Can you tell us a little bit about why that video was analysed and what you found?
Certainly. So the video, and some of your listeners will remember it, it was interesting for a range of reasons, technological, cultural and legal. From a technological point of view, it was one of the first videos that was uploaded of police excessive force, uploaded directly to social media, in this case YouTube, and then went viral through YouTube, Facebook and the sharing of the video on social media. So things that we take for granted now, at that time were, I guess, still in their early stages of reaching a critical mass. So that was the technological dimension. It also, in terms of digital media and social media, it certainly took control away from the police.
Mm.
In terms of them having control of the message, and it put them on notice.
Mm.
And also the mainstream media, it marked a point in time where we see this very obvious and clear distinction between the control of the message shifting to digital media and amateur video and what have you. And then obviously movements like Black Lives Matter have arisen off the back of this technology.
Yeah, absolutely.
So from the technological point of view, the sharing capacity of social media, and it had 1.6 million views over a week later.
Wow.
Which now, when we think about it again, doesn't sound like a lot of views, but that was only on YouTube, and then we've got Facebook and mainstream media.
All the times it was shared, so many eyeballs on it.
Yes. So it was unique in that case. But obviously police use of force has ongoing public interest because of the powers that are invested in police, but they also have an obligation to uphold certain rights. So how that balance is met and the proportionality of that relationship is always of interest.
Yeah.
Because things are often cyclical in institutional relationships with the public.
Yeah.
And we need, this is why law reform is important and a whole range of reform is important over time.
Absolutely.
But also the content of the video obviously was very very meaningful at a historic site of police abuse against the gay and lesbian community in Sydney.
Yeah.
Given the way that the Mardi Gras
started. Yeah.
And here we are today. It's the 41st Mardi Gras tonight.
Absolutely.
So the message is a good one to get out today. But also the way that it was an amateur video, but it was shot by a journalist.
Oh, okay.
So operating in an amateur capacity, he wasn't paid to do it and that kind of stuff. So the way that the video is constructed, the opening frame, for example, is a bloodied hand, the police officer's hand on Jamie Jackson's throat. So it set up this very very strong, I guess, almost like a David and Goliath struggle.
Yeah.
Between Jamie Jackson, who was 18 at the time, he'd lost his angel wings. He was only in a pair of black shorts. So in that sense, he might have been seen as a spectacle in his own right in the video.
Yeah.
But then the video opens with that, as I've said, this bloodied hand. And then what happens is that again, he's been handcuffed and then he's thrown to the ground for a second time. And it's that 18-year-old being slammed into the cement people remember.
Yeah.
So what that provides the public with is a more contextualised understanding of police use of force compared to, say, the nightly news.
Yeah.
Where you'll get a 30-second grab.
Mm.
And that's it. It's all the internet also allows for repeat viewing, so you can go back and go frame by frame. And people did this on YouTube actually with text overlay.
Oh wow!
And some people who had policing experience as well.
Yeah, okay.
So there was a proliferation of these videos.
Mm. That's the thing I think that the internet really offers an interesting opportunity to do is that discussion as well.
Yes.
That real connection and pulling apart and analysis.
And also this had very direct impact on the New South Wales Police because they're very heavily invested in social media to their credit.
Yeah.
But what happened after the video was released is that their default position was, well, we can't do anything unless there's a formal complaint made.
Mm.
After the video had been released, they launched their own internal investigations, unbeknownst to many members of the public and a lot of journalists even. So in terms of I think you're going to ask me a question about accountability a little bit later.
Yeah, absolutely.
But they launched their own internal investigations, but they told some of the victims that they couldn't do anything unless they had launched a formal investigation. Then on the Facebook page, you've got the police drilling down into aspects of the Police Act that you'll never get on the nightly news.
No.
Showing what their obligations were.
Yeah.
So this exposure and scrutiny forced the police to, I guess, reveal processes that they typically wouldn't have to deal with.
Mm.
And there's a notorious lack of public confidence in police complaints handling processes. But this is across countries, across jurisdictions. It's not just
universal. Universal, absolutely.
It's almost universal.
So going back to accountability and kind of pulling that apart a little bit more, do you think after all the research you've done that social media is a positive tool for increasing police accountability?
It's different. Well, I guess the words that I used in the thesis, because it's a thesis and you...
Yeah, you use big fancy words.
The distinctions made between pressuring the police to account and holding them to account. So media scrutiny can pressure the police to account. They have to provide details of what happened and what they're going to do about it.
Yeah.
But the back end of police accountability, as in police internal investigations, complaints handling processes, there's not a lot of transparency about those processes. And the general public, unless a journalist picks it up and gets access to the information, isn't going to be any wiser as to the outcome of those cases. And the media cycle will have moved on.
Yeah.
You know, we're in a radio station. Things just tail off and no one talks about them ever again. So in terms of substantial institutional accountability, I think it forces the police to consider how they might approach these things in the future. But the lack of transparency remains and is a sticking point. The other dimension of that is that in cases where civilians bring damages and costs claims, if the police settle out of court, again, there's a non-disclosure restriction on that.
You never hear from it ever again. Yeah.
And FOI requests a timely, costly and convoluted, and you may not get the information.
Oh my God, have tried one of those.
Yes.
Just
so in terms of substantive accountability, I would say no.
Okay.
But the ongoing scrutiny and exposure definitely puts the police on notice, and it's difficult to measure. Definitely within my research and the people I spoke to, because I spoke to 20 police and 22 community members within Sydney directly related to the incident.
Yeah.
It definitely put the police on notice.
Yeah.
But we don't have a measure of that positive or that good because we don't know how many times a police officer might have modified their behaviour because of that video. The other thing that happened was in conjunction was community organising, so a public protest, which is also a bit of a headache for the police because a week later... there was a protest at Taylor Square, walking down Oxford Street to the Sydney Police Centre, a community forum. The positive side to this story is that there was a memorandum of understanding signed the year later, in 2014, about how the Mardi Gras and it was policed between the New South Wales Police Force and the Mardi Gras.
Yeah.
So there was a positive outcome.
Yeah.
But as I said, institutionally, I'm uncertain that that... Yeah. has had a lasting effect.
Well, talking about outcomes and talking about the research you've done, you made a number of recommendations in your research. Could you tell us a little bit about those?
Yes. Well, one of the main points is that the police are very heavily focused on deterrence, which is necessary to an extent. But I guess one of my recommendations is to have more of a rights-based focus, which is what organisations like ACON do, Inner City Legal Centre, in terms of your right to legally film non-obstructionist police operations in public.
Yeah.
Which is the legal message from this conversation today and obviously timely for tonight.
Absolutely.
That it is legal to film non-obstructionist, so don't get in the way. And the other point that I didn't cover when we were talking about the video is that the arresting officer and his partner, they tell the guy filming six times to stop filming.
Which they can't do.
No. Well, what they should be saying is, "Can you move away? Can you move over there? Can you get out of the way? We've got an escalating situation." So,
yeah.
Again, we need to make the distinction between, you know, words matter. So, directing people to move away because they might be getting in the way of a police operation versus stop filming, don't film that, erase the data, because there are cases too where police will go to the lengths of trying to erase the data.
Gosh.
So, no, you're right. It's also very difficult. In that situation for members of the general public to maybe even know their rights in the first place, but then to sustain the filming when you've got two police officers.
Big.
Well, they were in this instance.
Yeah.
Telling you to stop filming and repeatedly directing you to stop filming.
It's intimidating.
It's intimidating.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So other recommendations were a review of the New South Wales Police Force Drug Dog Detection Program, which is not new. I mean, no. There are a whole range of researchers that have suggested that would be a good idea off the back of the New South Wales Ombudsman's review in 2006.
Mm.
And there's some recent research that has come out about that. If people are interested, they can follow up with that.
We'll pop some links on the podcast.
Yeah. Also, it was surprising that there wasn't that much research into LGBTIQ public sentiment into policing.
Okay.
And that's also happening with some other research that I'm involved with now. And also a whole range of other measures about police accountability.
Gosh. But I think the big takeaway I'm taking away from it, especially given that tonight is Mardi Gras and there are a lot of people out there, is know your rights.
Yes.
You can, in a non-obstructional way,
Yes, you can.
Wow.
And if you do want more information about that, as I said, ACON and the Intercity Legal Centre.
Yeah.
I have very good information about it.
It's very, very interesting research, and it's very, I guess, timely research, and also, you know, 21st century. Many people don't understand the impacts of this. But unfortunately, Dr. Ellis, we'll have to leave it there. We're out of time. But thank you for joining us this morning.
Thanks, Jess.
That was Dr. Ellis there chatting to us about his research. We'll pop a bunch of links on the podcast at the end of the show. It's 6